The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton. John is the president of Etherton & Associates, and today we're going to tackle the current state of acquisition reform, not regulatory reform. We got to do acquisition reform, statutory, NDA, all that good stuff, and the current state of play. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger.
Okay, well, let's start. What is the state of play? Where are things? You know, we've had a NDAA go through the House. You know, I know the Senate's working on it. Can you just lay out
where we are on the
chessboard, so to speak, right now?
Yeah, I think it's always a good idea to reset with the process. So where are we? Give us an idea how these things are likely to unfold. The House has passed the bill, their version of the defense authorization bill. They've also passed their version of the defense appropriations bill. The Senate Armed Services Committee has reported their bill out of committee, and it was almost on the floor on Friday. And so that didn't happen. So if it is going to come up, it may come up in September after the recess. Now, of course, Senator McCain has been diagnosed with cancer, and he's going to have treatments in Arizona, and we'll see how all that goes. That may have some impact on the schedule, but I think the plan is at this point to try to bring the bill up in September. And then they'll go to conference, and I think we probably will not see the defense authorization bill or the appropriations bills, for that matter, in any sort of final form until the end of the year, just because their top lines are different and drastically different. We have issues with the Budget Control Act caps and a number of other things that play into that. So I think all of the money issues have to get worked out before we can get to a final
version. And can you talk a little bit more about what the money issues with the, you know, we do have the Budget Control Act, right?
Right.
And, like, you know, the DOD budget, proposed budget is over the cap,
it's
right?
Over the caps, and the two Armed Services Committees believe that even the requested budget, while it's over the caps, is not adequate. So they added some additional money in the House. The case of the House and Senate was about $20 billion. The House Appropriations Committee on their defense bill more or less approached the House number in the authorization bill, but they also embedded in that about a $30 billion chunk of money called revitalization, which is really not assigned to any specific program. And that's sort of out there to be used, I guess, to pay for things for readiness purposes. The Senate number that they've allocated under the Senate allocations, and the Senate Appropriations Committee has not yet marked up their version of the defense appropriations bill, but they're basically looking at last year's number with a slight increase for inflation. So you've got a spread of about up to $40 billion between all these different bills. And they all came in at somewhat different levels, on the overseas contingency operations. And all of them, with the exception, I believe, of the Senate number, are well over the Budget Control Act cap. So they're going to have to figure out some way to address this. A further wrinkle is the fact that if we start at the beginning of the fiscal year in October with a continuing resolution, the cap for fiscal year 18 under the Budget Control Act is lower, much lower than the cap in the fiscal 17 budget. They will use the fiscal 17 number as the top line, and so we could be in a position where sequestration would kick in January if something isn't done to address the issues on the Budget Control Act. So there's a lot of pressure to do something, but where those numbers come out, how much gets allocated to the base budget, how much gets allocated to the overseas contingency operation portion, which is not subject to the cap, I think all that's on the table. And then, of course, the non-defense side is another issue. So I think all of that will really have to be settled before we're going to see these bills in any sort of final form. So having said that, there are a number of policy issues.
Well, I have a question first, John, about the budget.
Ahead. Yeah, sure.
So how does it work? Do people, is the negotiation amongst the various versions of the budget for the defense side worked out first, and then they looked to the where the cuts would have to come, or is it holistically done together? I mean, how does that work?
I think the Budget Control Act negotiations will be holistic.
Okay.
Because the Democratic leadership in the House and Senate have both said that they want to see an increase in the non-defense side as well as on the defense side. That they're willing to go along with some increase, though as yet unspecified, but they want to see an increase on the non-defense side as well, again, unspecified. So they'll have to negotiate something out. But I think most of that discussion will go out on the leadership level. There will be a lot of inputs, especially from the Appropriations Committee leadership. But I think there will be a holistic approach. I just don't see how they can break these things individually and move them.
Right. Okay. So they could, so you couldn't come up with one number of one and then just offset for the other. It's got to be, it's a give and take across the board.
Right. The caps are separate. So they're going to have to deal with them as separate issues in a larger framework.
So, and then there's always that talk of a big infrastructure package down the road. How does that play into this, or is just that complete unknown?
I think that's a complete unknown. There was a lot of discussion on the infrastructure side of having some sort of privately financed approach to that to allow
for like the hot lanes in Northern Virginia, right?
Right. Yeah. And there were some explorations around that. I think one of the issues that you get into with private financing of large projects where the return may take many years is the rules, OMB's rules on leasing and scoring and things like that, which would complicate that. So, but I haven't heard any, frankly, significant discussions about infrastructure or how that would work for several months now. I think the healthcare discussions and the debate really sucked the air out of the room and a lot of these things. And then I think now the discussion, if they move to tax reform, I think you're going to see a lot of focus on that as well. But these shorter term issues on the Budget Control Act, we have the debt ceiling, which now it looks, the latest timing I've heard is that needs to be addressed by the end of September. I think a lot of these things will be pressing as we get into the fall.
Do you see that being addressed?
Oh, I think it'll have to be addressed.
I mean, they can't. I mean, I can characterize it as dysfunction that you've seen over the last,
right,
trying to do healthcare. I mean, at what point does a straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of...
I don't think the debt ceiling at the end of the day will be that difficult. I think it can be treated as a standalone issue. I think it's really going to be... People will feel the need to discuss it, need to discuss the implications of it. And how do you factor all that into the other things that are going to be out there in a very short work period in September?
Yeah.
So that'll be the challenge.
Okay. So back to, the acquisition reform, defense procurement, or just defense policy / operations legislation in the NDAA, what are the big issues?
Well, I think that the House and Senate, again, have sort of gone in different directions. In their authorization bill, on the Senate side, I'll just, as an aside, the staff had said earlier in the session that they thought this would be a light year for the Senate, and I'll just note that they used the numbers all the way through 899 with some letters involved as well.
That's the new light year, right?
Yeah, that's right. I guess it is. They have
the new normal.
They have a lot of provisions in their bill, and if you look at the amendments that have been introduced for when the bill comes to the floor, there are a number of other issues there that'll also are raised. So it could be a pretty full thing. But I think if you look at the House side, they started working on their issues last fall and had a number of different things that they wanted to do. I think probably the one that is likely to get the most discussion is Section 801, which is the government marketplace or the private sector marketplace idea that is out there sort of as an alternative to the GSA schedules, and using a portal that meets certain specifications, and people, see that as sort of an interesting issue, one that I think has a number of controversial elements to it. Are we talking about a marketplace or a more of a metaphor of a grocery store? as far as market product placement and that sort of thing and access to the market. I think there's a lot there to be worked out in terms of discussions and things as we get through the fall. That, I think, is probably the biggest issue, but they've also touched on a number of other things. There is...
And you know what? We're already up on the break, John, so we can touch on those number of other issues when we come back from the break. My guest today is John Etherton. He's president of Etherton & Associates, and we're talking about the NDAA, some of the key acquisition-related legislation in the House and Senate versions, and some predictions on where we think things will be going. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates, and we're talking about, again, it's that time of year, the NDAA, the House version. Right now, we're talking about, I think, a little bit, what are some of the other provisions? We've touched a little bit on 801, and John, I might want to come back to that a bit. But what are some of the other interesting provisions that are in the House version?
One of them in particular that I find interesting is there's a provision dealing with the performance of incurred cost audits by the Department of Defense. There's been obviously concern over the last several years about the backlog that has accrued on incurred cost audits that the Defense Contract Audit Agency is responsible for, and people have pointed to a number of different factors as reasons for that. But one of the responses that Congress put in place a couple years ago was to basically say that if the backlog was more than 18 months, that the Defense Contract Audit Agency was not allowed to offer their services to other federal agencies other than the Department of Defense. And so what that led to was a reliance by some of the agencies on private third-party auditors to do some of the work. And apparently, my understanding was that that experience was actually fairly positive. So there's language in the House bill which essentially provides for the use of third-party private sector auditing services, as well as setting standards and sort of moving to more of a generally accepted accounting principles approach to performing some of these audits with some standards on materiality that are legislated, and a number of other things that have been sort of longstanding issues of discussion for several years. I don't know where any of that ends up, but I think that will engender, again, a lot of discussion about what the appropriate role of the government is, to what extent the generally accepted accounting principles can be reconciled with government accounting principles, and how you deal with issues like proper allocation of costs on cost-type contracts and things like that. So that is another issue that I think is fairly interesting.
Well, so along those lines, it just, you know, when you describe that, that's incurred cost audits and government's cost accounting principles, all that is just, it's a ecosystem. Is that right? Right mm-hmm. way to say it?
Sure.
So here we're really talking to me about changes around the margins of it. You're still talking about generally accepted auditing standards, et cetera, to try to make sure, in a certain sense, right, when I think about audits in that context, is that the government is paying for what it's supposed to be paying or what it gets, right?
Right.
Overall. So how can this be that controversial? Is it more the oversight community versus, is it the issue of private third parties doing the audits versus government people doing the audits?
I think there are a couple things. Number one, I think it's what sort of standards do you use? And are the standards that apply in the commercial side or the private sector side appropriate or sufficient to protect the taxpayer interest in government audits when you have cost-type contracts and other kinds of things where you have allocation rules that are different than generally are applied in the private sector? I think that's one issue. The materiality issue has been a longstanding issue that people have raised, that because of the fact that whenever the government does an audit, the cost of doing that is really never factored into the recoveries.
Sure.
And there's a certain degree of independence, which is appropriate, I think, in many cases for the auditors, that people tend to fixate on certain things where there may be a relatively small dollar amount, and both the company and the government spend even more than could possibly be recovered in the actual auditing process. So to set some standard on materiality that's never been laid out in writing or anything else that I'm aware of, to do that, I think, is a pretty big deal. I mean, that could really impact the day-to-day operations of how the audits work. So I think that's another area that is controversial. Is there a way to come up with materiality standards that can be sort of laid out in some predictable way that would allow for things to move more smoothly and in a more streamlined fashion? So I think there'll be some discussion around that issue as well. So I think it's, and then of course the other issue is, where you've got limited resources at DCAA to do the audits, is it reasonable to assume that you can rely on third party audits at least for some portion of the workload in order to get the backlog caught up? Is that a viable strategy? And I think that's really the third issue.
Okay, and it seems to me materiality is, I mean, that almost goes to it does go to the process.
Mm-hmm.
And then a sense of paying, the auditors and the lawyers and everybody circling around, the process, materiality would directly impact, their participation in it in
right,
a certain
exactly.
sense, right? And that's, I think, seems to me that's a controversial piece.
Or, mm-hmm.
Right. So what are some other issues?
Some of the other things deal with reliability, maintainability, and sustainability on major programs. This has been a long-standing concern of the House Armed Services Committee. Year after year, they put provisions in place to try to get greater visibility and more decision-making around operation and support sustainment costs for major programs earlier in the acquisition process. This year, they've got language which essentially creates a liability for defense contractors who are supplying a system to meet certain reliability maintainability standards, at least through the testing, developmental testing, operational testing process. It raises a number of sort of issues as to sort of how you measure that, what sort of contract specifications, at what point in the program is it appropriate to sort of put these standards in place and for everybody to sign up to meet them when the system, what point does the system become defined enough for that to be a realistic thing to do? And, to what extent, how do you measure that and how does that affect contractor incentives in this area
sure.
and other areas? So you've got a number of different things there that are in play. Interesting to see how that, how much of these things can you make a contract requirement? And then have some sort of an enforcement or clawback provision, whatever it is, down the road where companies would be responsible. It's difficult in particular for the department because I think everybody understands that you've got systems that in many cases will be in place for decades. And to what extent do you try to tie decision making at the early stages in the system design and commitments that are made in reliability, maintainability, where those may be the significant source selection factors, how do you then tie that to performance, which is going to stretch decades? I mean, is there a reasonable way to do that? So the House language would essentially try to do that at least up through the testing period. Beyond that, I don't know if anybody has a real clear idea of how that would work. But that's another issue that's been raised. And in a related way, there's language on intellectual property, which essentially tries to, I think, come up with a system for regulating intellectual property and technical data rights and how those things are administered across the department. Number one, there's a sort of a recommitment or re-emphasis on specially negotiated license rights and, mm-hmm. more nuanced approach on intellectual property and the government's delivery of data rights. And then they also have language in the bill that would create a center of excellence kind of approach to intellectual property so that you would have a cadre of experts who would be responsible for developing policy and implementing that policy across the portfolio programs that the department purchases.
Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me. I think that it does raise some questions, though, in terms of the relationship between the decision-making and that organization with the broader decision making that might take place either in the service or in the program office or whatever, where various trade-offs and things. I mean, who really controls at the end of the day what those policies are going to be? But I think all those things can be worked out. I mean, we've already gone down that road to some extent with the commercial pricing cell that was set up in the Defense Contract Management Agency. I mean, again, the idea there is that you get a sort of a cadre of experts who can look at various commercial approaches on pricing and provide advice to buyers across the entire enterprise. I think that's what this is really intended to do. It's my understanding that staff went out and did talk to many of the program offices in preparation for this and found that there was a great variety of views on what the requirements were for intellectual property acquisition of technical data rights across these various programs, and there wasn't really sort of a standard standardized understanding of those things. So I think this is an attempt to do that. And I think the real challenge, though, with the sort of directing people to really focus on specially negotiated license rights is, again, that takes a level of skill and understanding.
Yes.
That may not be resonant in all the places where folks would want to do that. And so the question is, do you have a workforce and an organization that can support some of these more nuanced approaches to intellectual property that industry has been calling for, which in the long run would probably incentivize perhaps more creative approaches to various technological issues from industry and greater investment of industry funds. But on the other hand, there'll be some costs associated with creating this ability on the government side. So the question is, do we get a good trade-off there? And I think that will be a discussion that we'll have over the next several months.
Well, John, we're already up on the break. When we come back, let's talk some more about a little bit more about the House NDA, then look at the Senate and just get your thoughts. It seems to me this is, I think you've said, made the observation before as well, that this is about year three, right? In a quote acquisition reform tsunami, so to speak, right? And I think that's fair to say. And just we want to get some context overall, the big picture, what's going on here. My guest today is John Etherton. He is the president of Etherton and Associates, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guest today is John Etherton of Etherton and Associates. And when we took the break, John, you were running through some of the key things you saw in the House NDAA. I think you have one more you wanted to mention, and then we can turn to the Senate a little bit.
Sure. I would just point, what I consider to be kind of a sleeper issue in the bill, but could be very consequential in the long term, is in Title VIII, Part 4 on transparency improvements, Sections 831, 832, and 833, which really drive the department more in the direction of using data analytics internally with the data that it's already gathering and processing to do a better job of managing the acquisition enterprise with more standardized formats and that sort of thing. It, in my view, continues... what I saw was sort of the landmark philosophy of Frank Kendall, which was to have more of evidence-based acquisition policymaking and decision-making in major programs. And this language that's in the House bill would really drive the department to modify its internal business processes to basically have an ability to capture the data and use it in different aspects and different functions in the acquisition side. And I think that has a tremendous amount of promise in the long term. So that's one thing I'll just mention.
That involves investments by the department in its systems and trying to figure out how to standardize things where internally for reporting purposes and all that.
Right.
Right. And presumably they'll be relying on the private sector to try to help them figure that out
I think it's a matter of interfaces and data formats and that sort of thing. And so, it's interesting that the Hill has really started to focus on this more and more as a promising area. I also think there is a longer term view that by having this data in a sort of form that can be spread out across the entire enterprise and used in different functions, it will also improve Congress's oversight abilities because presumably they'll have access to this information as well. And they can also use it for their oversight function. So it's been pointed out to me, talking to the staff about this provision, that they believe that the department has in any number of systems gathering information in various places, either in the services or at the Office of Secretary of Defense or in the defense agencies. And it's just a matter of sort of capturing that and making that data more available to a broader number of offices for their oversight and management functions. Similarly, in their view, to what many companies have learned how to do. So,
right, and it seems to me it would make it more efficient what they already have to do, right, in terms of reporting to Congress, right?
Right.
Yeah, hopefully. So the Senate NDAA.
I think if you look at the Senate, it's a little bit more of a sort of a collection of different ideas. Again, is more on the commercial item side, some further refinement of the definition of commercial items, more authorizations or authorities to use commercial and non-developmental items or items from so-called non-traditional contractors, you know, greater access to those. There's a whole section on the other transactions authority and trying to broaden the use of that and make that more or less almost the default model instead of the FAR model for acquisition. And so that's sort of the theme that sort of runs through a lot of what the Senate, I think, has been up to, streamlining, giving authorities to basically broaden the competitive base, even when you've got issues that there might be special statutory requirements or other kinds of requirements, to allow the authority for the Secretary of Defense to set those aside in order to get more competition.
So how, you know, let's now, I told you we'd come back to 801. Is there an 801 type provision in the Senate?
There is not. There is not. That'll be an open issue in the conference. And I have not heard of any attempts to do anything on the floor as far as a floor amendment. I haven't seen anything on that. So I think that will be an open issue for the House and Senate to work out.
Okay. And any guesses on how that would go, or is it too early to tell?
Well, all the parties that have been in the discussion, at least that I've heard from, have all endorsed the concept of moving in this direction, of using these commercial marketplaces
providers
and that sort of thing. And so I don't think there's fundamental disagreement conceptually. I think the real question is, what sort of requirements, how do you address certain issues like protection of the data in the process that might be valuable for intelligence purposes or whatever, compliance with government unique requirements that might still be in place that are statutory, issues on access to the marketplace. I mean, what do you have to do if, in fact, the portal is more like a store rather than a marketplace? What do you have to do to get access to shelf placement and, you know, how your products are presented and things like that? How will that be effectively neutralized, I guess, in the implementation of this? So I think there are a number of things like that. How much competition do you have between different portals so that you don't get sort of dependent on one or two, that sort of thing. But those to me are more operational discussions rather than a conceptual argument. And then I think longer term, the question is there a thought about migrating to this approach with respect to the GSA schedules? Do the schedules have a value added as government vehicles that are something this portal really couldn't provide or could provide? I think there are a lot of issues like that because the House provision is not limited to DOD. It's government-wide.
Right. It goes to GSAs. Yeah. So it seems to me one of the things that I've been thinking about the portal, and this is last question on this. We're going to move on to just the big picture a little bit. But this is part of the big picture. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that, you know, you hear criticism of schedules or whatever is about the pricing, and you can find it cheaper one of these portals. You know, it seems to me the portal is a delivery system in a certain sense, right? The underlying requirements drive the price.
Right.
And unless you're going to attack the requirements or address the requirements, maybe that's a softer way to say it, you're still liable to end up with the same sort of pricing issues. There's a difference between government unique requirements. Even the Trade Agreements Act in and of itself makes a huge difference in price points where things are made, right? And
right.
So how you address that in something that's purely commercial versus a government platform, that's the tougher questions, it seems to me, whether or not you should try to use, you know, a commercial-based platform. You know, even the government tries to use commercial companies to build its platforms.
Right. Well, and I think that the issue of compliance is a big one for a government buyer. I mean, how much can you guarantee
yes.
that something that you get via one of these portals is fully compliant with whatever government unique requirements are out there? Or does that burden get shifted to the buyer, right? I mean, I think if you work it through
right.
the GSA schedules, you pretty much know that you're buying compliant products. And how does that – I mean, I think all these things could be accommodated, but I think the real question is, as I said, I think you've got a number of implementation issues, you know, with that. And then you have to look at the relationship of this emerging portal for the schedules, the types of things you buy
right,
on the schedules,
sure.
services versus products, you know, it raises a number of issues. But I do think it's good that we're having the conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, it's one of these things where people, we could talk about it and never really have to reach a meaningful conclusion. And I think this, I don't know if we reach a meaningful conclusion by the end of the year, but I think it will get us far down that path, the discussions around this provision.
Well, John, you know what? We're already up on the break. This is our last break. So when we come back, let's talk about sort of the big picture. As I mentioned, you know, this is like year three in a tsunami of acquisition reform legislation. What does it all mean? Where are we going?
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we creating, you know, parallel universes of acquisition, those kind of questions. My guest today is John Etherton. He is president of Etherton and Associates, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton, president of Etherton Associates, and we've been talking about the House NDA, the Senate version, where things are going. And, you know, John, I mentioned this tsunami of sort of acquisition reform, and I think we're in the third wave of it, so to speak. Can you put some context on this and just where we are and sort of how did we get here in a certain sense?
Well, I think we, at least as far as the House is concerned, this is the third year. Mr. Thornberry has said that next year they're not going to do as much, that they've kind of gotten to the point where the reform effort will move in other directions, but they do want to finish it up this year. I'm not sure the Senate has that same sort of timeline. I mean, I think they're out, you know, pushing these ideas. There's been a lot of activity in the Department of Defense. You've seen a lot with the better buying power initiatives that started even earlier. Where it all goes is not really clear to me. I think the general theme is that the cost of the process is probably too high, at least people's feeling, not only in terms of the dollars to pay for the administration, but also the time. Are two elements that people feel are excessive with the current process, and we need to shorten that and cut things out and do whatever.
Do you think,
do
you think the thing that's, to me, when you talk about money and time, it's always been money. I think people have always recognized that,
right.
per se. But, you know, time, people have probably, because of the way the nature of the commercial market and technology, the rapidity, of change, how fast things change in technology, that time has become a bigger focus and
right.
costing not just money, because time is money, but also costing capability.
Right, correct.
So
yeah, I mean, I think that's an issue, and it's combined with the fact that the commercial market is producing such sophisticated products that have potential defense applications that are available to anybody in the world who wants to buy them, right? So if technology is going to be our edge, then where is our edge as a country in terms of our militaries, especially if things take so long? So I think that's been the major preoccupation of this latest round of reform and the cost of administering the process as well, that we don't really have a lot of insight into that. And we make decisions because we treat different pieces of this as a free good, that the government side, the cost of whatever process you have to do pricing or audits or whatever it is, that you don't have to sort of factor that into your decision making. So therefore, you know, you have these wild expenditures and then the time factor that plays into it as well. So I think that's probably the big theme. I think one of the things, though, that's going to be interesting is the fact that we've basically put a hold on the regulatory process. So as much as Congress passes this legislation, and you look at this huge package that came out in the FY17 bill, The Senate package is very large, and combine that with the House, we'll have a huge package in the FY18. And yet there's no process currently. Things are not moving through the pipeline for implementation. So at some point, you can jam as much as you want in there. If it's not coming out the other end in some form, you have to wonder what is the point of it all. The other issue to watch, though, too, and this is mainly from a DOD perspective as well, is the organization and the reorganization of the Undersecretary for Acquisition and Technology and Logistics, with that split, with the devolution of program management responsibilities to the services. That is just now sort of getting underway, and that also is part of this whole process of trying to de-scope the cost and the time and things like that in the process. So I think there's a lot still out there that we're not going to really see the results of, I think, for several years to really be able to do a serious assessment. So right. Again, I think the fact that we've sort of hit a regulatory freeze right now is going to delay that even more.
So when one of the things that has struck me is that, this, creating capability or authority, I guess, so to speak, to go outside the FAR, right? Whether it's other transactions authority or even language about, providing, opportunities for non-traditional government contractors, and then the traditional folks would go create a company that would, a subsidiary or whatever, mm-hmm. affiliated, that would qualify as such, which is an added cost in and of itself.
Right.
Do you see any, it seems to me, are you creating so many different potential channels or choices that, is going to make it more chaotic than it otherwise would be, or even just trying to benchmark, another OTA versus a FAR-based acquisition to try to get some sense of where you get a better return?
I think that yes and no. I guess, yes, you are creating a lot of these different pathways on top of many myriad pathways that already existed. And I think if we were to document all the different pathways, it would be, in the thousands probably for some of these things. I think the challenge really is for the workforce to try to cope with all this, where they're, being measured in various ways with compliance and certain processes, and people are being told, let's go out and do more other transaction agreements instead of FAR-based contracting. Where's the expertise? How are people getting the understanding to really effectively deploy those tools? Do they become tools that are sort of niche kind of things that certain activities really know how to use and other folks just generally avoid because they're too difficult, or they put people out of the range of things that they're comfortable with. I think managing these things through the workforce, I think, is a real challenge. And I think there's a little bit of inkling of understanding of that if you look at some of the provisions and the requirements to create new courses and things like that for the workforce. But people need to remember that we have a workforce. I think the acquisition workforce, people, really a lot of demands being placed on that workforce. People have so much time and attention. Being measured by certain more traditional metrics, and how you migrate that the people and their capabilities and break them away from things that maybe aren't as important to things that you now think are more important. I don't think anybody's really come to grips with how you manage that. And so I think it's a very difficult, stressful time for people in the workforce right now as they're having all these new authorities and requirements and other kinds of things put on top of them when the old ones are still in place.
Right.
That burden has not been lifted. And the workload is just really high for the individual people in many places in the workforce. And so managing that, I don't think and Congress traditionally has not done a very good job of that. I think their tendency is, well, we have all these issues. We want folks to go out and do all these things. And they don't look back and say, well, then maybe we shouldn't be doing this, or this anymore. One thing gets layered
right,
they don't
cut anything out.
Right, exactly.
You say what you will, that executive order on 2-for-1, right? You eliminate two regulations for every new one. That might be something there.
It has a possibility. I think I could think of maybe more efficient ways to evaluate the effectiveness or the value of regulations in that, but that's You know, I want to see this actually work in practice.
Yes.
And see how these things get measured. There were a set of metrics that were put out by OMB as to what that actually meant. But I want to see how it works in practice before I render any judgment on that.
Yeah. So, you know, just to finish up, you know, this wave of acquisition reform that we've seen, you know, we do have a, you know, regulatory freeze right now. There's just nothing coming out. Is it your sense? Do you see a department that's opening and welcome to this approach or some reticence to it? I mean, I think it's a flip from Congress previously was saying was skeptical of commercial item or commercial, right. You know, sort of, you know, capabilities and utilizing those. Now, all of a sudden, Congress has embraced it. And I think institutions take quite a while to come around to that type of thinking. Is that your sense?
I wonder if we will see a replay of what happened in the 90s and the 2000s. Congress basically fully embraced the commercial paradigm in the mid-1990s with the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act and the Federal Acquisition Reform Act. And what we found was that the Department of Defense could use some of that, and there were some real low-hanging fruit cases that I think people looked at as a demonstration of the value of it. But I also think some of that overlooked the challenges that the department has when they buy something, especially a large system or whatever, that they're going to have in the inventory for much longer than the private sector would ever have any of these things.
Yes.
I mean, they're constantly discarding, and that's just not the model that the department has. And so there are limitations, I think, on the whole commercial model that I think as we go forward with some of these ideas, we're going to run up against the same issues. You know, how do you maintain something where, you know, over time the department becomes the only buyer of it, that the marketplace has moved on and moved into new technology? You have the issue of diminishing manufacturing sources for some of these things, for unwillingness of companies to continue to support
right.
a product that's been, you know, rendered obsolete in the commercial market. I think those are still real issues, and so I think there are definitely some areas where we need to expand our use of commercial items. I think the system needs to be friendlier to it, but I think a lot of the same issues that we've been wrestling with and how to do this are still there.
Right. Well, John, on that note, we have to end the show. John, thanks for all the insight. I really appreciate it. So my guest today has been John Etherton. He's president of Etherton & Associates. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.